from bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Hear, hear. Thank you, Oliver. Ollie Barrett there at FSN. It is Wednesday, isn't it? It is Wednesday. It's the 27th of March, and it's 2019. I'm Richie Allen. You know that. Looking forward to hearing from you during the course of the programme on Twitter, the usual Twitter handle. I think I've got two excellent guests lined up for you. Lots of things to talk about, as usual. It is good to be alive, I tells you. Good to be alive.
Richie Allen.
Yeah, that's the one.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, this hour, Hayden Hewitt joins me, the co-founder of LiveLeak.com, the broadcaster himself, very good friend of mine. We'll be talking about the EU copyright directive passed by the EU Parliament on Tuesday. The provision that shifts the responsibility for stopping copyright infringement onto online companies and how that's going to impact on the independent media. It's very important that. We'll get into other issues around privacy with Hayden as well. He joins the programme this hour from North Manchester. And Michael O'Dara joins me in the second hour. I'm very excited about this as well. Michael is the co-producer of the outstanding must-see documentary The Great British Mortgage Swindle. This film is 10 years in the making, and it deals with institutional mortgage fraud in the UK and the impact of that on ordinary people like you and me. Michael O'Dara joins me live in the second hour. So that's an eclectic mix. Lots to talk about there. Michael O'Dara, The Great British Mortgage Swindle. I recommend the film. I really do. And we'll talk about that more in our two. The copyright stuff is hugely important as well. I think a lot of people don't understand it, not because they're thick, they're not thickos. The language used around it is confusing, even for anybody. You know, for anybody who has a command of the English language, the legalese around it, people say, what's going on with that? We'll dig into that with Hayden in about 16 minutes time, maybe 17, shortly before 5:25 anyway. Now, you heard Ollie Barrett there. I'm not going to stick with this too long because I know that it's fatiguing. There is no such word as fatiguing. It's winding people up, the Brexit thing. But tonight, just after 7, MPs will vote on 8 amendments, and they're basically debating those amendments right now as we speak. This is about the future of Brexit. They're trying to see, is there a majority in the House of Commons for what next step to take in the whole process? So the measures that are being debated now and that will be voted on later on include leaving with no deal, forming a customs union, and a confirmatory referendum, which is basically a second referendum. Theresa May is still looking for support for the deal that she struck with the European Union, which, as you know, has been voted down twice. So all of that is going on. The media is full of it. If you switch on to BBC News 24, if you switch on to Sky News, any of the radio channels, it's wall-to-wall coverage of it. And I know it is depressing. I really do know this. Spare a thought for me, would you? I can't get away from it at all, no matter where I go. Apparently, Theresa May is meeting with the 1922 committee, the Conservative 1922 committee, right now, or about now anyway, and presumably that's going to be about when she's leaving. When are you leaving, love? When are you leaving? When are you leaving? So that's it, really. It's all over, isn't it? It's all over, really. This is the death throes. It's like a fly that's stuck to the sticky flypaper. Do you remember those disgusting things people used to have in their houses? And Brexit is like a fly that's flapping around and kicking and struggling, but it knows that it is beat, it's over. There is a lot of triumphalism in Brussels. You won't be surprised to hear that. Donald Tusk is the EU Council President, and Tusk wants us to pay attention to the 5 million people who signed the Revoke Article 50 petition, and he wants us to pay attention to the 1 million people who marched in London last weekend, because they're the real people says Donald Tusk.
You cannot betray the 6 million people who signed the petition to revoke Article 50. The 1 million people.
You can't betray the 6 million people that signed the petition, even though many of them are not English people. This has been proven. This petition has been thoroughly debunked. And it's also been proven that people were able to sign it multiple times very easily without even having to set up email addresses. So we can't betray the 6 million or the 1 million.
People who marched for a people's vote, or the increasing majority of people who want to remain in the European Union. They may feel that they are not sufficiently represented by the UK Parliament, but they must feel that they are represented by you in this chamber.
Yeah, so they were in Strasbourg today, not Brussels, I must correct myself. He was basically saying that we've got to look out for the interests of those who don't want to leave. Something that was very interesting this morning, now I didn't record it, but if anybody wants to hear it, they need only go to BBC Radio 5 Live podcasts, breakfast podcasts, because the breakfast show on BBC Radio 5 this morning had an academic on, and I can't remember who off the top of my head, but the academic was brought on to talk about the Lisbon Treaty. Now, Brexiteers have been speaking about the Lisbon Treaty in the last few days and how it was a guide of sorts to the super federalist state that the European Union is becoming. So the Lisbon Treaty was signed by Gordon Brown in 2007, ratified by the UK government. We rejected it, the Irish, you might remember that, and the Danish and the French rejected it. And the European Union said, feck off now, lads. Sure, you can't say no. Go back and vote again. And we all went back and voted again until they got what they wanted. Now, that actually really happened. And it was that accent as well that they used to cajole us into voting again. Go back now and vote again now, to be sure. So we did. And most people who voted no to Lisbon just didn't go out and vote, and Lisbon was ratified. But this academic this morning on BBC Radio 5 Live said that there are loads of conspiracy theories about the Lisbon Treaty. And he said that the treaty did not point the way to a federalist superstate and the end of sovereign nations. Now, the BBC sicko presenters didn't know enough to argue with him. Or maybe they did, and they were told not to argue with him. I don't know. But anyway, the guy said that member states would always be governed by their national parliaments, and that the European Union is basically benign and works on consensus. Now, I laughed so hard at this that I made a little bit of wee-wee in my underpants. What a liar, I thought. And I don't get annoyed anymore. You'll remember I used to get angry with radio presenters. I just don't care anymore that they didn't jump in. The Lisbon Treaty... basically ratified the introduction of an unelected president of the European Union and a foreign minister. It also introduced a common foreign security and defence policy, complete with embassies, diplomatic staff and an EU foreign and security minister. Yes, the European Union with embassies in countries around the world and a foreign and security minister. It also introduced something called La passerelle. Now, I didn't even have to ask the future Mrs. Allen, what does passerelle mean? It means passageway. So what did the Lisbon Treaty do way back in the year 2007? Well, it allowed and does allow the European Union to annex new areas of policy by a simple decision of the Council of Ministers with no need whatsoever to refer back to national parliaments to get permission, you understand? Neither does it need to call a new referendum. Some people call that the self-amending treaty, which made it terrible, really. It's really fascistic, this, right? Lisbon was all about, how do we get around national parliaments and their sovereignty? Look it up if you don't believe me. But I like these little Jack and Ori type chats that we have, where I give you the little bits of information you might not know. Also, Lisbon confirmed that lobbyists working in Brussels, like lobbyists for big pharma and biotech companies, they are not required by law to register their interests. Right? So they don't have to register their interests. They can lobby away and lobby away. Have a wee listen, and then we'll leave Brexit altogether for today. Have a wee listen to Guy Verhofstadt speaking a couple of years ago. Now, he's one big, thick, ignorant fucker, Guy Verhofstadt. You see him often on television at the Parliament in Strasbourg or Brussels. He's an ignoramus, he really is. I often look at Verhofstadt, and I think he should be wearing dungarees and a straw hat. Proper ignoramus. He is the current leader of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe. And, of course, he used to be Belgian Prime Minister way back in the day. Now, this little audio clip was recorded 2 years ago, and it is Guy Verhofstadt explaining and laying it all down, dear listener, what the European Union is meant to be and what it will become. Guy Verhofstadt.
The member states have always feared of an in-depth reform of the Union. But let's face the reality. They are with their back against the wall. So it's now the moment to reform the European Union.
It's the moment now to reform the European Union. To do what?
It's a real union and not a loose confederation of nation states still based on the unanimity rule.
Not a loose confederation of nation states based on the unanimity rule. So what did he mean when he said that? Well, he said the European Union shouldn't just be a loose association of pals based on unanimity, which is consensus. So basically, it should be much, much, much closer together, and we should get rid of consensus. Listen to what he says now.
Unanimity rule. Always acting too little, too late.
So he said, because of this unanimity rule, where we have to get consensus from all the member states, sometimes we act too little and too late in areas of serious policy. So we basically need to do away with that.
You cannot govern a continent like Europe if you still need the approval of all 28 member states.
Right, so if we need all 28 member states to approve, we can't effectively govern Europe. So we've got to do away with that.
So that's the first thing to do. Then a smaller...
That's the first thing to do. We need to get rid of that consensus.
Or a less bureaucratic, real European government. Not a commission of 28, but a small commission. And then also, yeah, a European Defence Union, because there is a threat from outside the Union. We see it in our neighbourhood, in Ukraine, in Syria. We need also a European Border and Coast Guard to real man.
European Border, Coast Guard, European Defence Union. The Defence Union means centralised control over the collective armies of the member states of Europe. That's exactly what it means. Right? It doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be wearing a European Union army uniform, which some people said at the time. It doesn't mean that. It means that centralised control, the power to direct the armies of Europe, taken away from national sovereign parliaments. This is lovely, isn't it?
The migration flows. I think that there is no other solution for Europe than to do these in-depth reforms we are proposing. Because otherwise we're going to disintegrate further. It happened already with Brexit. Other countries could follow. We don't want a number of institutional reforms in the Union because we like institutional reforms. We want it because we think that we will have then better instruments on the European level to tackle the challenges that people are seeing today.
Now, that isn't the first time I've played that particular bit of audio. It came up on the programme a couple of times during the referendum process, or not during the referendum, in the aftermath of the referendum. And that's it, really. You know, that's from effectively the horse's mouth. This is what the European Union is going to be. I say that people keep that in mind. Whether you voted Remain because you felt that there were some unsavoury characters on the Leave side, people on the far right, and you don't want to be associated with them, leave your identity and your own political beliefs to one side for a minute and be honest enough to look at what the European Union is and how it is beyond Orwellian, where it is going and where it's meant to go. Right, shall we drop the European Union? We'd love to. Let's drop it from the programme. Loads of coverage of Rockland County in New York State. This came up yesterday, and its decision to ban under 18s from public places if those under 18s haven't been vaccinated against the measles. And I came across this today, and my friend Ian, a listener to the programme, sent me a message on Twitter, and he said, "Did you catch this, Richie?" Thanks, Ian Shilliker, by the way. And I did catch it, because I do have the World Service on as well, because I used to hear the World Service a lot when I was in Spain. And this is the Newsroom programme, and they've covered this crazy situation where under-18s who haven't been vaccinated against measles in Rockland County from midnight tonight, that's Eastern time, will not be allowed out, or at least go to public places anyway. BBC.
A suburb of New York City has declared a state of emergency and banned unvaccinated children from all public spaces after a measles outbreak. Rockland County has taken the step after recording more than 150 cases of the highly infectious viral illness since October. Ed Day is the Rockland County executive.
The focus of this is to get your attention. Understand that under the color of law now, you cannot bring your children to public assemblage areas unless they are immunized. So either do one or two things, comply with the law or get a shot. If you get a shot, the kids can have a good time.
If you get a shot, the kids can have a good time. That's a law enforcement officer. Batshit crazy, I would have said. And there are some parts of the United States of America, I could imagine a cop firing on someone who has an argument with them about this vaccination thing. You can't go in there. Well, I am going in there. You haven't been vaccinated. Well, that's a load of old bollocks. I'm going in anyway. I could see weapons being drawn on people. It's pretty crazy, isn't it? Isn't it crazy?
For a month from midnight on Wednesday, no one under 18 who hasn't been vaccinated will be allowed to enter any place of public assembly in the county. Well, Neda Tofik joins us live from New York for more on this. Neda, tell us the background to this.
Well, you're not going to believe it, but they're blaming Jews for this. It must be a sport. Let's find the wildest and wackiest things that we can blame Jews for. It's apparently the Jews. It's Orthodox Jews in this part of New York.
Well, back in October, the way the measles outbreak started was that a few people from overseas had brought it to Rockland County. And the epicenter of this outbreak was the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, where they tend to have lower vaccination rates and they have religious exemptions from having their kids vaccinated. And so authorities had really started from October to have vaccination clinics, to have rabbis go out to the community and explain the importance of immunizations. And think about this. They pulled 6,000 students out of school in December. They had a ban on kids going to school who weren't vaccinated. They handed out 17,000 vaccinations, and still this outbreak, they couldn't stop it. And so this is why officials now are taking these aggressive steps.
That's the most important part of that little clip there. They gave 17,000 vaccinations, and it didn't make a blind bit of difference. There was an outbreak anyway. Maybe the vaccinations themselves had something to do with it. Although they repeatedly tell you, time and time again, they say that it isn't a live virus in the vaccine. It can't give you measles or it can't give you flu. But again, that's been disputed by biologists in the past and people I've heard from on this particular programme. It's the Jews, bloody Jews giving you measles, eh? Orthodox Jews. They wouldn't say that about Jews, because it would be deemed to be anti-Semitic. But Orthodox Jews, because of their anti-Zionist stance, I suppose they're fair game. I don't know. This one will make you laugh. Queensland University Technology Researchers, that's Queensland University Technology Researchers in Australia, have said that the term cyclist dehumanises cyclists and leads to drivers treating them aggressively, apparently.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah. Cyclists shouldn't be called cyclists because it dehumanises them and leads to drivers treating them aggressively. This is the real deal. And Ben Fordham presents a radio show for Sydney Live, and he spoke with somebody from Queensland University, a woman called Professor Narelle Hayworth. This is how it went.
I understand that you are a cyclist.
I'm a person who rides her bike to get to work.
You mean a cyclist?
Well, other people might think of me like that. I'm probably not your lycra cad clad, and I'm certainly not male in my middle age.
How long have you been uncomfortable with the word cyclist?
I think it started about 5 years ago when we found some research from Western Australia that was suggesting that people thought differently to the term cyclist and bike rider.
Maybe that's just because cyclists have a bit of a bad rep.
I think that, yeah, people have an idea in their head of what a cyclist is like and what a cyclist does, and maybe that just doesn't match, you know, the whole breadth of different people who are out there riding.
So you reckon there are some who are letting the rest of the team down when it comes to their behaviour on a bike?
Yeah, there certainly are, just like there's some car drivers who, you know, we're not terribly happy with.
So how is this going to change if all of a sudden we started calling them people who ride bikes?
I think we can get the idea that those people could be any of us. They could be our kids, they could be our spouses, they could be our parents even. So I think the idea that we're all people is something that we need to push when we're having to share the road.
I've got to say I'm a little bit surprised that 55% of those who did the study did not identify cyclists as being human. They said they were less than human.
Yeah, they said they weren't completely human on a scale from 0 to 100%. And I think that is a challenge, because when we don't see other people as fully human...
But maybe they were being sarcastic, you know. If somebody rang you up and asked you were you a car driver, and they wanted to determine that you're not a cyclist, so you're a car driver, good, I want to get your opinion of cyclists. And they're asking you questions like that. When you say you don't see them as fully human, you're not being serious. You're being sarcastic or being a bit silly, right? I mean, right? Yeah.
People as fully human, we're less likely to respect them and to do the things for them that we want done for us.
But, I mean, that's the bizarre thing. Anyone knows that there is a human being riding that bike.
Mm. And I think it's a bit like the way we think of motorists rather than drivers.
Do you want us to call them people who drive cars now?
No, I'm happy to call them drivers, but calling them motorists sounds like, you know, they're some sort of machine.
So you don't want to be known as a cyclist anymore?
No, I'm happy to be that old bird on a bike.
The old bird.
Professor, thanks for your time.
The old bird on the bike, that was Ben Fordham there, Sydney Live Radio. Genuine survey or study, and the recommendation was to drop the term cyclist and use person who rides a bike. It wouldn't be worthy of comment if it wasn't for everything else that was going on in terms of what we should say and what we shouldn't say, and words we should use and words we shouldn't use. It's kind of a bit mad, isn't it? Graham Booth, who co-hosts the Trigger Warning show with Hayden Hewitt, said, "Stop that hate speech. I'm a person of wheels." Yeah, that's right. The thing is, people who drive cars and who do not cycle. Now, I don't cycle, but I run a lot. So I have occasion sometimes to be annoyed with the behaviour of drivers. So I can see it from both angles. I drive and I see cycles behaving like morons, which I see a lot, right? But I also see drivers doing very dangerous things on a daily basis. You know, I drive Princess Road, Manchester, around South Manchester, the city, the ring roads, and it's crazy what people do in cars. But cyclists are lunatics. And I see the same type of aggression in cyclists that I see in motorists. Neither one is better or is less culpable than the other. I see cyclists doing incredibly hateful, angry things for no good reason. You know, not just driving through red lights and, you know, playing chicken with drivers, not just cycling on the wrong side, passing on the wrong side, smacking the hoods of cars, the bonnets of cars, being general idiots. Neither side, I suppose. But the thing that is very worrying, we might get into this with Hayden Hewitt, is legislation that the European Union are pushing through, which will see cars built in the European Union from 2020 being fitted with, automatically, each car built with a speed limiter to make it very difficult, if not impossible, for drivers to go over the speed limit in whatever speed zone they happen to be in, whether it's on the motorway 70, whether it's 30 or whatever. It's all very interesting, this. 27 and a half minutes past the hour. Hayden is slightly delayed, But we'll be with us in a couple of minutes' time. That's Hayden Hewitt from LiveLeak.com. We are going to talk about the EU copyright directive. It does have profound, if we can say that word, profound implications for independent content creators. And I did give an example of this on yesterday's programme, because I can only speak about this particular show. But I've had a running battle with Google, YouTube, for quite a long time now. And it's taken me months and months and months to get somebody, a real person, to send me an email about monetization. Because I initially was under the misapprehension that the reason my YouTube channel was declined for monetization was because they thought I was an imposter. You see, I had a YouTube channel that was deleted. And initially it looked like they were accusing me of re-uploading my old content and telling me that I was re-uploading someone else's content. And that's the way it was in the beginning, a year ago, when this YouTube channel was then put together, you see. So this obviously drove me mad, because it's my content, it's my stuff. And I said, no, it is me. You deleted my channel with nearly 100,000 subscribers last February for no reason. And I appealed and you turned me down. So I opened a new channel, told you who I was. It is really me. Well, what they've said to me, they've got back to me and they've said, you can never monetize your channel so long as you are reusing content. So again, I said, right, finally somebody has spoken to me. What do you mean? It's my intellectual property, those interviews. And they said, no, when you take a 15-second clip from RT or a 45-second clip from Sky, that's reused content. You can't monetize. It's not yours. It's copyright infringement. And I said, no, it isn't. The law in the UK has never seen that to be copyright infringement. The law in the UK has been explicit that once I am using that little bit of audio to make a point, to illustrate a point, or to critique it, and once I am identifying the source of that material, which I do, of course, all the time, you heard me today, BBC Radio 5 Live, even the BBC World Service, even the Sky News, you always do it. And they came back and said, no, tough, basically, tough shit, Paddy. So that is directly related to this EU copyright directive thing. It's absolutely imperative in a fair and free and open society that independent content creators can criticise media companies that are owned by massive multinational conglomerates, and that we do that by sometimes taking some of their content, a little bit of it, first of all identifying it and then playing it. That's essential. And that isn't copyright breaching. That's the way the law is in this country right now. But the European Union wants to basically say, no, 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 you can't ever do that. And that's not fair. That's anti-democratic. It's fascist. It's spooky. It's terrifying. It's scary. It's Orwellian. No, you can't take that little bit of audio and use it. You see, I don't use that audio as my own. I don't claim it as my own. It's not mine. So I say, Kay Burley speaking with such and such a person on Sky News. Have a listen. See what you think it is, because I think this person is talking through his or her sphincter, maybe. It's very important. And when we get Hayden Hewitt in a minute, we'll jump right into that. In the meantime, though, I've got some music from the brand new Heavies for you. Midnight at the Oasis. Yeah, the brand new Heavies on The Richie Allen Show, Midnight at the Oasis. Right, so I told you at the top of the programme, you knew anyway, the EU copyright directive was approved by the EU Parliament even on Tuesday. And worryingly, that directive includes a provision that shifts the responsibility for stopping copyright infringement away from copyright holders and puts it squarely onto online companies that allow users to upload songs, videos, articles and other content. And I believe this will have a pretty dire effect. It will have devastating consequences for the independent media. That's not me being, that's not hyperbole. It's not me overselling that or being, you know, sensational. I think it's true. Hayden Hewitt is a broadcaster, of course, triggerwarning.tv, terrific show he makes with Graham Booth. I mentioned Graham earlier on. The Live Leak show, of course, which is a fantastic program, very funny and very pithy as well. And, of course, he's the co-founder of LiveLeak.com, which has been in the news lately, of course, around New Zealand and the Christchurch shootings. And it is one of the biggest and most widely used websites in the world. And fresh from attending his son's school, he's rushed back just for the Richie Allen Show. Cheers for that, mate. Thanks for coming back on.
No worries, fella. Thanks for having me.
It's not sensational to say it's going to have devastating consequences for independent content creators. You know far more about this than I do because it's vital for LiveLeak.com, of course, and for your other interests. Explain it. What's going on?
Well, the first thing we have to look at, I think, is the law itself and how it's been sold. Like all such legislation, especially vaguely worded legislation, it's been sold as protecting copyright holders. And you can't argue against that, can you?
No.
You can't. And all the follow-back pro-Europe folks who I bump into on Twitter quite frequently, they say you can't argue with that. And they're right. You can't argue with that until you look at how can you implement it. This is actually ridiculously difficult to implement. You're looking at, they say they can do it with algorithms. I had that explained to me yesterday. Very kindly, someone took the time to explain to me how video uploading works. And they said, well, they can just tweak the algorithms to find copyright content. And I pointed out YouTube can already do that if license holders submit the media. But to catch clips and everything else would require a hugely draconian approach. It would be simpler to say, we're not letting you upload any of that in Europe. Finished. Much simpler. Because an algorithm can't have nuance. It can't understand fair use.
Yeah.
It can't understand these things. And it's not in their interests to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on programmers trying to make it do that.
Does algorithms mean artificial intelligence?
Yes, of course. You know, they're used throughout the major platforms. They do already protect copyright. They can, you know, remove things. Often they're a very blunt instrument, though. Like with the Christchurch shootings, people found if they were uploading a video that had the same music in for a while, that was getting killed.
Is that right? Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, but that, you know, it's just YouTube, to play devil's advocate, Google were doing what they could do to stop that video going up, and they rectified it and changed it and did what they could do. And it's an incredibly difficult process. And the EU legislation is very vague. It's then got to be interpreted by all 20-odd member states. Can you guess how the UK are going to interpret this?
Well, before we talk about that, this is really interesting stuff. Hayden Hewitt is on the line. Where has this come from? Is this something that the European Union dreamt up itself, or have they been lobbied unmercifully by some of the biggest firms in the world?
Of course they've been lobbied mercilessly. It never stops. Lobbying's rife in the EU, same as in any large governmental organisation. Unfortunately, I don't have my notes with me because I've just rushed back, but the chap that proposed the law detests the internet. Right. He detests it. Please do go and dig it up. If I get his name after from my notes, I'll pass it over to you. Make no bones about it. What they're doing here is not only damaging in and of itself, and which people might say to me unfairly, I suppose, you know, it's self-interest that you're concerned about this, even though Live League doesn't have a massive problem with TV shows and things being uploaded. And we've managed to deal with it reasonably well without new legislation.
Yeah, it's important to mention this, by the way. LiveLeak.com, which Hayden co-founded, I'm not overstating how huge it is. It's massive. And you've been able to cope with, over the years, the occasional letter from a copyright holder saying, dear Mr. Hewitt. And that's the way it's worked forever and a day, right? Somebody says, Hayden, that person is using my content and they shouldn't be doing it. And if you find it to be true.
There's ways of dealing with it. Yeah. You know, we've always managed to work with them. Yeah. It's never gone legal.
So it's not a problem then. That's the point I'm trying to make. Well, this isn't a big problem.
Look at Ruptly, the, you know, RT's video agency. A lot of their stuff was being uploaded. So we just got, we formed a media partnership, which meant they posted instead. You know, so yeah. There's lots of ways of working these things out. YouTube have got very successful ways with, you know, ensuring, you know, if you upload something copyrighted and have monetization on it, the money will go to the copyright holder.
Now, this is good. This is good, my friend. I'm so glad you brought this up because I left my notes somewhere else too. I made notes for you. No, honest to God, I did. And this is one of the points I wanted to make. This is very good. I sometimes, when I edit this program, accidentally leave 5 or 6 more seconds of the end of a song. Like there was a bit of music on before you came on today, before the show goes on to YouTube later, that will be edited out, of course, because it's not mine. But sometimes you leave a couple of seconds more than you should, and YouTube comes back to me and says, don't worry about it, it's no big deal. I don't know, Columbia Records has said that you can leave the video up and they'll monetize. So that, to me, everybody wins, right? So why hasn't that been a
amicable solution?
Lovely, perfect. It's not my music, but thank God I can leave the show up there. It's not going to be deleted. So why hasn't this been adopted?
Because the EU don't care for that. And also, you know, I'm not usually given to tremendous conspiratorial leaps of deduction.
Unlike myself.
Well, obviously, yes. Yes. But with this kind of overreach and everything else that's going on, do we honestly believe this is where this stops?
No, that's
do we honestly believe this won't be used to suppress? We've already had David Cameron saying 9/11 truthers should be silenced.
Yeah.
No matter my thoughts on it, I've never advocated people to be silenced.
No, that's right.
Alex Jones, a man with whom I disagree on virtually every issue, he's still hosted on Lively because I don't think he should be silenced.
Too right.
I detest deplatforming. I think it has the opposite effect of what they want. This legislation will not change one iota in terms of copyright theft.
No, it won't, and it won't enrich. It won't enrich further the likes of the Rolling Stones or Ariana Grande or whoever. It just won't.
It won't benefit anybody.
No.
And you know, of course it's being sold in the nicest way possible, but look at the legislation they're trying to put through in the UK. I had a big an email exchange with Ms. Powell, the Manchester MP.
Oh, God, yeah.
About her proposed legislation for combating terrorism online. And she came back to me and I told her why her legislation would fail, why it wouldn't affect terrorism in the slightest. And I mean exactly why. You know, based on years of experience. And I was roundly ignored for the experts.
She wants to tackle online hate with law, doesn't she? She wants to introduce to law. Right, it's coming back to me now. This is Manchester Central.
Site owners for people upsetting other people.
Yeah.
But it's also about combating terrorism, because as we all know, terrorists all hang out on large forums.
It's ridiculous, yeah.
So we see where this is going.
Can I interrupt you just for a second? So have you concluded that then? Because you are, I've always found you over the years to be very moderate. You don't jump in with 2 feet, and you always allow a bit of your mind to be just left open to whatever comes across your desk that might give you a different perspective. Are we thinking now that this has got nothing really to do with unfair copyright infringement, and that it might be more to do with old Mr. Orwell, further down the road, dystopia, where...
There's 2 options here, and none of them go to a good place.
Yeah.
Got the Orwell version, but I think the more likely version, in truth, which is probably not as exciting, is that this was born by lobbying, by people with no understanding of the technology, doing what governments do, which is drafting legislation. But my concern is not even that. It's that these tools will then be put in place. Once tools to control information are put in place, it's inevitable that this will be abused. Regardless of what you think about any conspiracies or anything else, it's inevitable. Look at how they passed the legislation, Richie.
Yeah, that's right.
They changed the article number and then, during the session, changed the order of voting, which when you're voting on a lot of things, MEPs, the poor delicate little souls, can't be expected to keep up with what's going on around them. They need a list. It was changed. Now, some of them have complained well, we didn't want to vote to that, which beggars belief. I think they should be just fired on the spot.
But they're basically window dressers, the 750 yeah. MEPs. They don't have any power at all. There's very little they can do.
The rubber stamps, but a few of them are still going, no, this isn't what we wanted. This was changed on us. So they've allowed them to change their votes, but it will not affect the outcome.
This is very sinister stuff, this.
It's filthy. It's filthy.
It is filthy. Look, my listeners don't need me to say that I think it is the Orwell thing, because you've only got to go back to Cameron at the United Nations talking about we can't tolerate this and we can't tolerate that. You mentioned Lucy Powell, which is a great shout there, and the constant, almost daily bleating by elected officials about how we have to stop certain things being heard or being seen. Loads of comments on this, unsurprisingly. You can follow Hayden on Twitter. You know this anyway. It's at Hayden Hewitt, or it's at Hayden _ Hewitt. I think it's at Hayden Hewitt.
It's just at Hayden Hewitt.
At Hayden Hewitt on Twitter. Triggerwarning.tv, liveleak.com. People are talking about back to CB radios. Some people are laughing when they're saying that. Some people are saying, well, hang on a second. Maybe that's the way it's going to be.
I genuinely think we all need to take this far more seriously. I think we take for granted the internet. Take away my LiveLeak associate. I've loved the internet since I first got on it. Granted, I spent the first couple of years just trolling the shit out of it.
But yeah.
I adore it. It's the greatest communication device mankind has ever known. It's the greatest repository of knowledge we've ever known. You see people out there who usually have follow FBPE in the title, and they call themselves socialists.
Yes.
My favorite, democratic socialists.
Right, which isn't socialism, of course. You and all both understand that. Democratic socialism is not socialism.
What these guys don't realize, the internet, not in the whole, but the most important tenets of it are essentially democratic socialism. It's a level playing field. You don't have to have privilege to succeed. You aren't hindered by your gender, your sexuality, or anything. Anybody can prosper. Anyone can communicate. Anyone can have their views heard. Anyone can build the next Facebook. You don't have to be a Zuckerberg. You know, it can be anybody.
It's very important you're saying that. It's very important you're saying that, because it's true. Anybody articulate enough or who's got the literary skills can open a website, and if their writing is good enough, if it's coherent enough, they'll do well. Well, that's the way it was anyway. Obviously, things have changed
in
recent
years. Out in the real world, you can have the greatest idea.
Yeah.
But if you can't get the funding, if your face doesn't fit, it will never go anywhere.
Yeah.
On the internet, you can build. You can take years. You can minimize the costs. You can do all these wonderful things. And all these guys that adore socialism are trying to help kill it. And what they're doing with the EU, and I make no apologies for saying this, the EU represents the worst possible form of socialism I could imagine. Do you know why? It passes all the power to the states, which is still embroiled in corporate cronyism. It's the worst possible kind, where all the power goes to the state.
The state,
all of it.
The state being Brussels, and 27 unelected commissioners and a president that was unelected, and MEPs that, as you said, can only, you know, briefly halt any diktat that comes from the Council of Ministers, only briefly. They don't get to propose legislation, MEPs. It's a farce, really. You and I won't know this, regardless of what we think.
All the legislation's drafted in secret.
In secret.
How can that possibly be democratic?
And you also mentioned the lobbyists, which you did well to mention. Lobbyists in Brussels and in Strasbourg do not have to register their interests. This is a fact. This is the very definition of totalitarianism, fascism. Give it whatever label you want.
And you've got Verhofstadt coming out blatantly saying, you know, now that Britain's leaving, it's time for us to do away with all your concessions. And basically, we know the veto's got to go.
Yeah.
The veto can't stay. The main reason we won't be allowed out is, you know, everyone says, you see a lot of the pro-European people. So I shouldn't say European, because I really like Europe. I just don't like the EU. Pro-EU people saying, well, we need them more than they need us and all this. But they're forgetting that if we pull out, what you're essentially left with in terms of financial power.
Financial muscle,
nine states. that's what the equivalent they'll be left with.
And it's a very, very salient point you're making here, because many of those states have already been raped and plundered by the European yes. Union, and there's nothing left to rob. That's
and now in Germany, Germany, there's a lot of problems because they're saying, this is France. France are doing this. This is France and the Club Med states.
And the French are blaming the Germans. The Yellow Vest protesters yes. are blaming the Germans. It's wonderful, isn't it?
And an ex-French foreign minister came out saying, oh, no, it's just because the French government hate the British. Sorry, the English.
The English.
Old enemy, you know. This shit still goes on. And people are there going, well, it's better than having the Tories. It's like, no, because they're never going to get elected again in a generation.
Well, it's interesting. It's very interesting you and I are talking right now, because unsurprisingly, the breaking news right now is that Theresa May has acknowledged that time is basically up for her. She won't be there for the next stage of negotiations with the European Union. She's basically accepting she's only got a couple of weeks left in the job. So, you know, way back in 2016...
Please not go.
It'll be Penfold. And it'll be...
This lets me down. I wanted Johnson.
It'll be funny one way or the other.
I just wanted Johnson. That's all I wanted. If we're all screwed, I might as well get a laugh out of it.
Unleash him on the world, yeah. So,
can you imagine the Johnson-Trump summit?
Yeah.
Oh, delicious.
This is a bribe. This is a bribe, by the way. May met the 1922 committee an hour ago, and the reason she said to them, look, I'm gone, it's so that they'll vote for the deal, which is even worse than staying in the European Union.
Oh, that's the best part, isn't it? Theresa May's deal is categorically worse than remaining.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd rather they revoked Article 50.
Yeah. May's deal is like me living chained by the neck outside your back door. That's basically it, basically. That's the analogy.
There's no room for you. All my chains are full, dude. Oh.
Bring out the game. That's it.
Does this not just do what the EU want perfectly?
Perfectly. And there won't be another government that will dare come up, that will even countenance the notion of having a referendum. No other country. No.
No, that's it. After this, it's finished. There's no second chances.
Loads of tweets on this, Aidan. Loads of tweets. William Henderson, Rich Mortimer, how you doing? Thanks for tweeting the programme. They don't want us to leave because all the others will want to go as well if the UK were to prosper, that is, thereafter. Martin in Spain, Sean Hinchcliffe, how you doing, Sean? Loads and loads of tweets on this. Depressed. In the 5 or 6 minutes we have left, back to the copyright thing. One of the things you do very well on your programmes with Graham and programmes you've done yourself is lampoon and send up the media. And it doesn't necessarily need to be the news media. It can be the entertainment media. You do a marvellous job of that. And it's very important that we have that commentary and that we have that debunking of and lampooning and satire that you do really, really well. What I do in a very small way is take a little bit of audio. You mentioned fair use. And say, well, look, this is obviously questionable, so we'll do a bit of that. If this all goes to plan, we won't be able to do that.
No, not at all. That's why, I mean, I don't use media because usually we throw everything together at the last minute anyway. So,
but you do, and it works well when you do.
But no, that's finished. I told you about Drone Tech, the guy that I've known him since the inception of Live Leak. He was one of the first uploaders.
Tell our listeners that story as if they've never heard it, because it's important.
He's a conservative voice. He's an American. He's conservative. I don't like it. Everyone says right wing now. That's not what right wing means to me.
No.
He's conservative. You know, he's not really pro-Trump, but he is pro-conservative. He's Republican. But he's got a really moderate voice. He's very good. He put together these great shows talking about, you know, the liberal media or left-leaning media, whichever you want to call it. And then he was completely demonetized. He went into this for his living. There was nothing offensive. He didn't use great swathes of stuff. He spoke about clips. He addressed every comment in the clips. And they just cut him off at the legs and didn't give him the money that was in the account there. They said, no, that's it. You're finished.
That's horrendous to hear that. I mean,
it's dreadful. But you know what? I think Google are just getting ready for going, we've got no choice now. Because I know the default position is that everything they do is purely evil intent. But also, I believe they come to a point, well, this is how it's going to be. But in Drone Tech's case, he's American and broadcast predominantly to America. Why not just block it in Europe? So there's too much of this going on. That was, from what I can tell, it was for using clips. Because He's in no way, he's not like me, he's not foul-mouthed, he doesn't say offensive things, he doesn't say things that should get you a knock on the door from the police. He doesn't do any of that stuff. But I do all that stuff, but I don't use clips.
Yeah,
but then again, I'm not monetized either. So
here's a question. I mean, this is really going down Alice in Wonderland land or territory. Here's a question. Don't laugh at this, but could it be possible in the future that it would evolve to where you can't even refer to a quote from somebody? Imagine me and you and Graham Booth doing a podcast about films that we loved, and you recite something from the film Dumb and Dumber or a comedy or a thriller or The Godfather. It could go to that level, couldn't it?
Well, you could be done for singing Happy Birthday in public, in theory.
Yeah.
You mentioned films. Remember, I used to do a podcast with a guy called Chris called Netflix, Nerdflix.
Yeah.
It was just about films. We just spoke about films. We didn't use clips. We spoke about films because we love films. And we were uploading them to YouTube. And one time it said that one of our podcasts was reported, reviewed, removed, and our account banned. Problem was, the podcast was about an hour and a half long. That all happened in 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
The whole account wiped out, and it was the cleanest thing I've ever done in my life.
You know? I remember this, yeah.
We just spoke about films. It was hugely enjoyable, but that killed it for us. We didn't monetize it. We didn't want to. We just did it for the love of, you know, talking about films. So this is all going on. We're being attacked from everywhere. We've got the leftists pushing advertisers to pull things everywhere. There's massive pressure on platforms to submit, to right think.
We've had
bad times.
Dreadful times. We both of us have covered incidents where progressive groups have lobbied businesses not to carry on advertising with newspapers like the Daily Mail, because the Daily
and
Mail
websites, is a, there's a big movement now for that.
Yeah. And the companies, the businesses are so terrified of being associated with anything that's deemed to be unspeakable, unsayable, or anything unpalatable, that the businesses just give in to the progressives,
yes,
and don't say,
straight away,
piss off, no, I'll spend my advertising dollars with whichever newspaper I feel like it. No, they run away.
They respond on Twitter. They respond to them now going, we'll look into this straight away.
Yeah.
Say, if one of my businesses was advertising, someone said that's not the response I'd give.
I want to bring something up before we run out of time. I know you would. You've got the gumption to say, listen, there's no such thing as guilt by association.
I'm not going to say what I'd say on your show.
No, I know that. No. but the idea that, I mean, the Daily Mail is the most widely read tabloid in the country. The idea that I wouldn't advertise with them just because some goon thinks that some writer on the Daily Mail has previously been xenophobic.
Richie, because someone was upset.
Somebody was upset.
Living in a world where you get the police coming around because you upset somebody.
Yeah, the police.
What's going on?
On this theme, we've got about 4 minutes left. Thanks for rushing back, by the way. You didn't have to do that.
My pleasure, mate. My pleasure.
Fair play to you for doing it. I know you've got domestic. You're at the young lad's school. Great times going to the school and all that. Now, porn passes. Again, there's nothing funny about this. I was out running this morning, listening to Radio 5 Live. This government, or at least MPs, seem to be overwhelmingly in favour of introducing a law whereby anybody who wants to access porn must first of all prove their age, prove they are who they say they are. And one of the ways that they might do that is go to a newsagent and pay £5, I heard, this morning to be verified.
Sorry.
What's going on?
Do you know what, Richie? Okay, what I'll do, because we've only got a few minutes here, like you say, I'll get down the rabbit hole now. And if you come back to me in a year, and if I'm wrong, I'll be really, really happy. Okay?
Right.
If I'm wrong, I'll be over the moon. Maybe 2 years. Let's say 2 years. And please, if I'm wrong, I'll be over the moon. They're handing control of this to the BBFC, the British Board of Film Classification.
Yeah.
They're a group that sit down in that London and decide what fiction adults can watch. They don't just classify, they censor, they refuse certification to films. Human Centipede 2 was banned in this country, probably still is for all I know. I was talking to Tom Six about this, it's banned. Just in case we watch it and decide to stitch people in a big human centipede.
Yeah,
And molest them with a barbed wire wrapped penis, because that's what you do. You watch a film and you do it.
And you're compelled. You can't stop yourself. Yeah.
Well, me, I've got 8 of these centipedes now. I don't know what I'm going to do with them. But here's the thing, Richard. We've given this to the BBFC to control. So you come back and tell me if I'm wrong, that they don't roll this out to porn, to difficult content, and then using the BBFC to say what's acceptable on the internet. So you'll have to be certificated. Wow. And they'll set the guidelines for what's acceptable. So if there's a war like Syria, and let's say LiveLeaks putting those early videos up going, no, look, they're arseholes on both sides of this. Look what they're doing. No, sorry, you can't watch that. As an adult, you can't watch that. It's not got an 18 certificate. That's where we're going with the internet. And I hope against all hope I'm wrong, but this just smells so badly of that happening.
Right,
it really does.
We'll be speaking about this, obviously, ongoing. Remind our listeners where they can catch Trigger Warning and the Live League show. The stuff you do with Graham Booth is brilliant. You see me occasionally popping comments in there on YouTube when it's live. It's very good stuff. Remind us where we can watch it and when.
We do the podcast live every Tuesday night at 10:30 UK time. You can hear that on triggerwarning.tv. The podcast then goes out every Wednesday and sometimes on a Friday as well via everywhere, iTunes, Spotify, Podomatic, Stitcher, all the rest. Then on Thursday nights, 10 p.m. UK time, we do a Trigger Warning sort of TV show, which you can watch on LiveLeak.com, on YouTube, Trigger Warning TV, Facebook. We've still not been banned, so that's great, Trigger Warning TV. And, just come along, join in. And remember, it's not as journalistic as Richie's endeavors.
Or it is. You know, depends on your perspective.
Some of your listeners are so sorely disappointed when they come to watch the show.
I think they find it hilarious. And as I said, pithy. There's some very good commentary on stuff in amongst all the lunacy. There genuinely is. It's very unique. Mate, thanks for that. Very, very strange and worrying times. I appreciate that. It's important to get your perspective on it. You are responsible for one of the world's most used video sharing websites, the monster that is LiveLeak.com. But look forward to seeing you on the show tomorrow night, mate. Thanks for coming on today.
Cheers, Richie. Thanks for having me, mate. Always a pleasure.
You too, buddy. Bye for now. Hayden Hewitt, live from North Manchester on the Richie Allen Show today, the co-founder of LiveLeak.com, talking about the EU copyright directive passed by the European Union Parliament on Tuesday. As Hayden said, it does now go to the national parliaments, but there isn't expected to be any stagnation there, because the lobbying groups in Brussels are just as present and accounted for and correct in this country and in other European countries as they are in Brussels. So it's very, very worrying. It's as serious as it gets for the independent media. There's no two ways about that. Going to take the headlines from FSN just to see what's going on. Has anything changed? I don't know if they'll be up to date with the Theresa May news, but if not, I'll give you more on that when I come back. And then we're going to be talking about a terrific and very timely new documentary film called The Great British Mortgage Swindle, with one of the producers of that film, a man called Michael O'Dara. You do not want to miss that. We'll do that in a couple of minutes' time. Before that, though, it's off to FSN. Can we do that? What's going on? Can we do that? I don't think we can do that. I wanted to take in the headlines, but I don't think we can do it. After all that, no, we can't. That's all right. We'll go and do something else. So, questions about the creation of money and mortgages and the legality of mortgages. Just anything you want to ask. Michael O'Dara is the man to do that, and he will be with me in a minute, right? I can't take in the headlines. Can you believe it? So it's got to be music. It's got to be music from Brian Ferry. On Your Richie Allen Show, of course, for the 27th of March 2019. More live chat on Europe's most listened to independent radio show in a minute. This is Let's Stick Together. Thanks for listening to The Richie Allen Show. Music from Brian Ferry on The Richie Allen Show. It's 5 minutes past the hour, 5 minutes past six. The programme being live, of course, right now. Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester We're on a TuneIn Radio, of course, as well, richieallen.co.uk, triggerwarning.tv, lots of places to hear the programme. Just before we welcome Michael to the show, that news that broke in the last 25 minutes, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, has told Conservative MPs that she will stand down if they back her EU withdrawal deal. That, of course, has been voted down twice already by MPs. It's expected to be put back before the House tomorrow or Friday. Maybe it's Friday. May told backbench Tories, "I am prepared to leave this job earlier than I intended in order to do what's right for the country and our party." The BBC, Sky and other bureaus describing that as extraordinary and all the rest of it. It isn't that extraordinary, really. Loads of comments on the EU copyright directive and my chat with Hayden Hewitt there. Paul tweets, further to Hayden's comments about the BBFC, the British Board of Film Classification, it's also worth pointing out that although it's appointed by the government to classify content, it is a private organisation that charges content providers a lot of money for what it does. That's Paul. Thanks to Paul there. Gail says, regarding happy birthday, what could we say instead? Could we say, enjoy your anniversary of the day you were born, says Gail. Yeah, fair enough. Faisal tweets, though, that the copyright issue, around happy birthday has been rescinded and you can use it now in a video or in an audio track. Hi to Natalie Stacey as well. Loads and loads of tweets there, by the way. Let's introduce our next guest, and I'm really excited about talking to him. I spoke to him today off air, of course, and I told him that it's an absolute gift to be talking about his film. The issues that he's dealing with and his co-producers, I think, is one of the most important issues facing society. And I think it's a great way of opening a door for people in their minds to understand maybe the bigger picture of what's really going on in the world and maybe the institutions that are controlling our lives that maybe we don't hear enough about in the media. The Great British Mortgage Swindle is a terrific film, and it has been 10 years in the making. And it deals with institutionalised mortgage fraud in the UK, the impact that has on mortgage holders, ordinary folks like you and me, the impact of evictions by court orders, how those happen, how they come about, but also the creation of money, the role of banks and the role of conveyancing firms in the whole process. I'm going to be tweeting out links to where you can find the film. It's available on Amazon Prime at the moment, I believe. We'll ask Michael in a second. You can find links to it on the website, The Great British Mortgage Swindle. I'll put a link out to that as well. Let's welcome co-producer of this must-see film, Michael O'Dara. Michael, thanks, mate, for coming on the programme. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Richie. Thanks for having me on. And thank you for that lovely introduction, which is a pretty good summary of what the film's about.
Well, I meant every word of it. It's hugely important. It's a must-see film, and I'm really intrigued about the fact that it's been 10 years in the making. Why did you and your co-producers make it? It's Michael, isn't it? It's Michael Bernicia or Bernicia. You'll pronounce
Michael
it right.
Bernicia.
O'Bernicia. Michael O'Bernicia. The two, yeah. Michaels. How did you come together nearly 10 years ago to think about this film, Michael?
Well, I was researching into mortgage fraud around that time, and I found Michael via a mutual friend who lives in Derby. And as far as I know, we were the only two, really, who were actively researching it and preparing to take action, as it were. And we decided that it was, I mean, this is the thing, we decided this nearly 10 years ago now, and I think it still holds true. We decided at that time that mortgage fraud, institutionalised mortgage fraud, and the price that people pay just to keep a roof over their heads these days, was the one great issue that could possibly unite everyone, no matter what their background, their creed, no matter what false divisions they are operating within. This was the one issue that could potentially galvanise the people and unite us, really.
This is massively important. People are tweeting us already. And so somebody's listening to this program now. They're new to the independent media. They have a mortgage and they're paying it every month. They will say, right, Michael, break it down to me so I can understand. What is mortgage fraud? Who is committing a fraud? I've taken a loan out to buy a house. It's killing me, but it's what I had to do, and I'm doing it. Where is the fraud in the transaction?
Well, the title of the film hints at the multi-leveled nature of the entire swindle. From the deed of the mortgage charge or the deed of mortgage that you sign over to the bank at the behest of the conveyancing solicitor without full disclosure as to what its true value is. From the standpoint of the bank claiming it's actually loaned you monies and treating you as a borrower, through to fake eviction claims, the lack of compliance with the law that most mortgages in the UK are riddled with. I mean, if I could give a simple example of that, it was established in a Supreme Court case in 2014, Scott versus Southern Pacific, that no one has any right to sign a mortgage deed until they are the owner of the property in question. Now, in very simple terms, the whole swindle is dependent upon the mortgage deed, which in the majority of cases has to be signed. Well, it does have, at law, it should be signed in front of a witness. But what's happening on an industrial scale is that the conveyancing solicitors are encouraging people, well, they instruct their clients while simultaneously representing the bank's interests. So there's an example of one aspect of the fraud, the fact that your conveyancing solicitor is representing not just your interests, but also the bank simultaneously.
There's a conflict. There's a conflict. They're representing conflict two parties in a business transaction. There's a conflict.
But basically, this court case in 2014 established that no one has the right to sign a mortgage deed on a property they do not own.
Michael, what does that mean? Does that mean that they shouldn't sign the mortgage deed until the loan has been satisfied? So at the end of the 25-year term or 30-year term. Now, I kind of have an idea, but my listeners will want to know this. What does that mean exactly, that they shouldn't sign a property they don't own?
I'm not saying they shouldn't sign it, but of course you have to sign it for the credit to be created, because the mortgage deed, in the financial system, I'm talking about the monetary mechanics, the creation of the alleged loan, which is in fact the creation of credit, is based upon the signature on that mortgage deed, because that is an asset to the bank and that gets credited in an account which is on the other side of the ledger that the banks never show you. And the credit to buy the house is streamed from the deposit of that mortgage deed, which has then become a financial instrument.
And a fraud
without any disclosure. The conveyancing solicitor doesn't say to you, look, you do realise that if you sign this deed, you are effectively signing it as a receipt, a fake receipt, on the basis, you know, you're described in there as the borrower, and yet you've not received any monies, any credit, any advance of credit. And also, you know, it's the failure to disclose. The conveyancing solicitor basically doesn't know his ass from his elbow. They don't really, if they do understand the nature of the swindle, then what are they doing in that business? That's what I would ask. You see, when we say it's institutionalized fraud, you're talking not just about the legal system, but also all these accountants, you know. And how many accountants are there in Britain? Hundreds of thousands, I would imagine. Many of whom will be privy to the secrets of banking and will understand that a signature on a mortgage deed, which is a promise to pay over 25 years, is what creates the credit in a fiat currency system such as we have. And of course, that is a recipe for nothing less than financial enslavement.
This is the crux of it. This is the crux of it right there.
So who are you working for? That's the question. If your listeners are just coming to this subject for the first time, and they are paying out, say, what, in excess of 50% of their monthly income on this mortgage, well, who are they working for, ultimately?
Important, Michael. Now, I'm going to try and play the devil's advocate here. I know you've got the answers to these questions. So I'm going to try and play the devil's advocate. So Mary is listening to this, and Mary thinks, well, hang on a second. I'm not stupid. I don't have £195,000 to buy the three-bedroom cottage. I go to the bank, and they give me a compound interest of 3% or 2.5% or 4%, and I know that I'm ultimately going to pay back £298,000. I'm well aware of that. I don't like it very much, but I'm well aware of that. I'm kept up to date with that all along the way. This is your 5-year fixed rate. Later on, you might remortgage again, or you might pay whatever rate it goes on to. I'm well aware of it. I don't like it. I don't like usury. Don't like interest. But tough, you know, cookies. I'm well aware of it. So what would you say to Mary who says that to you? I, as the purchaser, I'm well aware that it's a bit of a stitch-up, but I can't find a way to buy a house any other way. What do you say?
Well, my simple answer to that is I wouldn't listen to Mary. I'd be listening to those who say to me, hey, what are we going to do about it, Michael?
Yeah.
We've all been conned. What can we do about it? And then, but, you know, I think she'd probably be paying, if she borrowed 198 grand, she'd be paying probably three times that amount back in compound interest and the rest of repayments over the 25 years. And would she ever really be able to pay it back? You see, that's another thing. Many people are mortgaged up to the hilt.
Yeah. And in arrears. Didn't the BBC do a survey back in August of last year where the numbers of people, I can't remember exactly what the percentage was, but the numbers of people in serious mortgage arrears was absolutely shocking. It was well in excess of 40% of people who hold mortgages in the country. An absolutely shocking figure, that. Is that the crux of it, Michael? Because that's what I want to get into. I just want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Michael O'Dara. Michael and Michael O'Bernicia have made an absolutely must-see film called A Great British Mortgage Swindle. You've got to watch this, and you've got to share it with other people. It's about institutionalised mortgage fraud, debt slavery, in the death, that's death, D-E-A-T-H, economy, what it does to people and how it's a fraud from the get-go. Because now we're into the area of what risk, in fact, has the financial institution, the building society or the bank actually taken in loaning you this money to buy this property. This is serious stuff, Michael. Back to you, because I want you to get into this for our listeners.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I was interviewed, Michael and I were interviewed through the week by Renegade Inc., which was broadcast on Russia Today. And the interviewer, Ross Ashcroft, was asking what practically would happen in the event that the mortgage industry in Britain collapsed. And Ross is a noteworthy director himself. He produced the film The Four Horsemen, which also exposes the illegalities of the financial system. And he was describing it as, well, I was saying, basically, can you imagine, and this is probably what I think is most important, if we're planting seeds, you know, first of all, we can take those figures of arrears, and if we really understand how the credit has been created, those are not arrears, that's actually another aspect of the fraud. It's a pretense that you were loaned any monies. But we're all brought up to know, aren't we, Richard, that yeah. If we borrow something, we give it back. If your next-door neighbour lends you his lawnmower, you give it back to him.
You give it back to him, but you've been given...
So that morality, you know, is within most of us, and, it's within most of those who are paying these mortgages. I don't think that level of morality exists within the banking fraternity, but that's an aside. And that's it. You see, people really need to get their heads around the facts behind credit and its creation in the system. What creates the money, so to speak? And once they understand, they won't be labouring under what they see as arrears. They'll understand that those arrears are fake, and it's a fraud that's being actively committed against them.
It's the loan never materialised, never existed in the first place.
Now, what came up, you see, Ross was describing it as that what would happen would be a renaissance. And it's been running through my head a few times recently. And I think he's right. Because if you can imagine the collapse of the mortgage market, which is apparently valued at £1.3 trillion. I mean, try and get your head around that figure. But that's how huge it is. That's how deeply the British public has been shafted.
So you signed the mortgage deed.
So the renaissance would be effectively people no longer have to pay these fake debts. Now immediately, imagine how much disposable income they've got, which would find its way back into the real economy. If the mortgage market collapsed, there'd be corporate losses, but you know, there'd be a massive transfer of wealth from the so-called 1% back to the people, who would be no longer slaving just to keep a roof over their heads. And you can imagine from that the energy levels of people once they're free of this financial burden would transform our lives. This is a question I could be asking about the film rhetorically. What's not to like about that?
Nothing. There's nothing not to like about that. There would have to be, you know, a serious rising of people, though. First of all, they have to understand this, because the most important thing for people listening to this for the first time to get their heads around is that when a loan is created by a bank, a bank is basically loaning money into existence that didn't exist before.
I think the expression loan is the wrong word. They're creating credit.
That's right. They're creating credit out of thin air.
And misrepresenting it as a loan.
It is money that didn't exist. It's credit that's been created out of thin air, meaning that from the outset, there is no risk whatsoever to the financial institution. That's passed on to the person who's buying the house. Most people in the country don't understand that, so they take that credit. Let's not call it a loan. They take that credit that's been created. They pass it on. Well, it's not passed on by them. It goes to whoever was occupying that house, and then they're into it then for 25 years. No risk whatsoever on behalf of the financial institution. This is fractional reserve banking. But of course, not only have they created credit that didn't exist, they've created an interest charge as well, meaning that there can never be enough credit in society to ever pay back those loans. And this is an important point to make to people who are very new to this information. Do you want to pick up this point?
Well, again, you said there's never enough credit to pay back those loans.
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing to pay back. No loan took place. I remember, if you borrow something, fine, give it back. But this is a very simple premise. And I can't really understand how people
can't get their heads around it.
Well, I know it's almost like a religion. You know, everyone believes in money, but nobody knows where it came from.
It goes back to...
It is like a religious control system, isn't it?
It is. Doesn't it go back to a time when financial elites basically lobbied or forced governments to allow them to loan, basically to create credit far beyond their actual reserves of hard cash or of gold and silver? There was a time when they were allowed to loan 7-8 times more than what they actually had. And that's where this begins, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think it was 1931 in Britain, when they removed the gold standard, when the currency was actually backed by something of value. You know, that's why it's called a pound, because it was a measure of weight.
And by doing that, Michael, it's Michael O'Dara, by the way, folks, live on the line to us today. Very important. I can't overstate this. I can't overemphasise it. The Great British Mortgage Swindle, the film, you have to see this film, 10 years in the making. At that stage, Michael, in the early 1930s, basically, elected officials gave control. It's going to sound sensational, but it's true. They gave control of the world, effectively, to a group of financial gangsters, right?
That's right, yeah. They're given credit creation over to a relatively small cadre of bankers.
Who send numbers from one screen to another screen. And look, the amount of comments, I can't get over the comments coming in here. Let me read a few. Cliff tweets, the banks lend money from our credit. With a mortgage, the banks sell on the debt through SPVs and get 90% back. They then insure, the banks then insure to, so after three missed payments, it pays out the full mortgage amount and then they take the house and evict. That's 190% back and sale of the property. It's a very important point Cliff is making. They also take out a fraudulent insurance policy against the borrower defaulting, don't they?
He's absolutely spot on in what he states there. When I said at the start that this is a multi-level swindle, that's exactly what it is. And that each of those aspects that he identified are accurate. Yeah. I mean, how much, it's as though, you know, nothing is ever enough, is it, for these individuals that operate in the banking system. I don't know whether there was a golden time when your bank manager, who was a figure to be respected, was an honourable man and acted accordingly. It's hard to imagine if you think about the... Because you couldn't imagine Captain Mannering in Dad's Army, who was a banker, shafting someone in this way.
No.
Could you?
No.
And I know that's a fictional representation.
No, but it's a good analogy. It's a bloody good analogy.
So it's such a responsible position to be in, that of a bank manager, you know, socially speaking. Because the whole... everything is controlled by the money. Everything.
It's the name that you're not supposed to mention because everybody describes you as anti-Semitic, but it's a genuine quote. Way back in the day, Mayor Amschel Rothschild said, and you know, the Rothschilds are not exclusively, you know, banks are banks. It doesn't matter whether it's Rothschild or Warburg or Goldman Sachs. It doesn't matter. But he said way back in the day, I don't care what puppet is on the throne of England. If I have control of the money supply, well, that makes me the king. He didn't say that exactly, but that's the paraphrasing of what he said. The secret rulers of the world are not secret. They are the institutions that have the power to create credit out of nothing, Michael.
Oh yes, and you know that we're not delving into the mists of conspiracy theory.
No.
We're talking about facts. It's well researched. You know, the information about the Rothschilds, whether or not they're actually Jewish, I would question.
Yeah, it doesn't matter either way.
I would describe them more as Sabbatean Frankists Boston. But whatever they are, they certainly have a grasp over the entire planet's monetary system. I mean, it's a fact that they control the central banks. People over here will try and persuade you that it's not true that the Bank of England is a private bank that's controlled by an elite. It's not true. The people own it. It was nationalised after the Second World War. Well, if you look a bit deeper into that, you know, that's the public face of it. But in fact, the Bank of England is a privately run bank that's largely, as far as I can see, controlled by the House of Rothschild, as are most central banks, pretty much all central banks across the planet nowadays.
I interviewed the economist Steve Keane about this. I've had him on a couple of times, Steve Keane. And the second time he was on, he argued with me on that very point about the Bank of England and what it is. And I made the point that you made, that it was vicariously controlled by these people. I've also had this argument with Paul Craig Roberts, the former US Assistant Treasury Secretary, who was a regular on the show, still is, Paul. Yeah. And I had this argument with Paul, who said that the Fed is not controlled by a number of financial elites. And I said, well, it is. If you look at it closely, it is. But to be fair to Steve Keane, he acknowledged on the programme, and I've played the audio clip a few times, Steve was honest enough to say, yes, it doesn't make sense that you would borrow from your own bank to pay for the business of government. And he acknowledged that. He said it doesn't make any sense. He said it's like Richie borrowing from the bank of Richie, or Michael O'Dara borrowing from your own bank to pay for your daily business and then paying yourself back with interest. So he acknowledged this.
When you put it like that, it's laughable.
It's laughable. And to be fair to Steve King, God love him, you know, and I know Steve's got to be very careful because, you know, Steve's he's an academic and he works in public life. But he said, yes, you're absolutely right, Richie. Why would the government of the United Kingdom borrow money at interest from the Bank of England, basically selling government bonds to the Bank of England that it supposedly controls? The answer is it doesn't control it. And you've hit the nail on the head there. Michael, is this, do we see what you're describing in your brilliant film, which again, I'm going to mention, and we're going to put links there. And folks, I'm saying to my audience, and I probably only say this every now and then, I don't say it often enough, brilliant independent filmmakers like this must be supported, because if you don't support them, they can't make follow-up films about other subjects. Get on to the Great British Mortgage Swindle and pay to watch this film. I'm ordering you to do that. If you haven't seen it, you've got to do that. Right? Spend a few bob and support brilliant independent films. Go and watch it, because Michael is going to tell me in a few minutes the film is going to be shown in various places around the country, including Manchester, and I'll be at the Manchester screening. I can't wait to see it. Michael, what you're describing, what ordinary British men and women are going through, we see this on a much larger scale with countries. Countries are indebted in the same way, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's spot on. And again, it's all even councils. On the international level, you're absolutely right. Even another example closer to home is the councils that are indebted to these banks over these so-called Lobos loans, you know, in inverted commas, which again are crippling. I mean, I don't know if they're crippling, but they're certainly the council tax. Every time someone's council tax goes up, you can rest assured a lot of it is going to pay the interest on these fake loans that they've taken out with the likes of Barclays to the tune of several million. So, yeah, it's a system of, it's a spider's network with a big fat spider right at the middle of the web.
And is it designed to basically take ownership of real assets? Because I've interviewed men and women over the years, John Perkins, who went to third world countries in South America, convinced them to take loans from the World Bank so that those loans could never be paid back, so that Bechtel and Coca-Cola and McDonald's could then go in and rape those countries. So if we go back to the ordinary man and woman, are these financial institutions giving mortgages to people as a way to acquire real assets and real wealth, which is the land and the bricks and the mortar?
Only on those mortgages which they would treat as being subprime. In other words, the ones where it's been overstated how much the individual earns per annum. And they're mathematically built to collapse anyway. But ultimately, no, I think once more, and suggesting it's a multi-leveled, multifaceted swindle, that those are certainly what aspects of it. But, you know, ultimately, it's the income streams from people's financial enslavement to it all. And as the previous listener said, you know, they've taken out insurance policies. Everything's covered if the mortgagor goes into alleged default. Alleged arrears. They've sold the mortgages on quite often as mortgage-backed securities. It's endless, Richie. It really is, you know.
How did you feel, Michael and Michael O'Bernicia, when you start? Now, I want to talk about evictions in a minute, because and all the problems with evictions and the legality and all of that. And I also want to talk about cases where people have taken the information that you have and try to represent themselves using that information. I want to talk about that in a minute. But before that, where was I before that? I've gone now. Right, we'll come back to that. Let's talk about the eviction process then.
And
because this is central to the film as well. And again, there's a fraud there. Let's talk about that. I mean, in the film, you're talking to people and you show people at the lowest ebb of their life when they're being turfed out of their house. That can't be easy, that, Michael, to witness that.
Well, as the documentary shows, I was actually evicted, violently evicted myself twice.
Yourself,
in the space of a year.
Jesus.
And no, there's nothing like it. You know? Nothing like it. And I maintain that no man has the right to do that to another man, particularly over fake debt. Every time I see, you know, footage of someone being evicted, it hits me firmly and squarely in the guts, you know, because I know exactly what that is like. Having said that, I was aware when we began documenting the whole thing that I may not be successful in court, and the ultimate outcome may well be that I would be unlawfully evicted, which I was. But yeah, I mean, that is it's indescribable, but you can imagine how much worse it would be. I mean, I was a single guy at the time. How much worse it would be for a, you know, husband and wife and a young family.
Yeah, people with young children.
So yeah, there's an immorality about the whole swindle as well. And these solicitors firms that are, you know, making these false claims against thousands of mortgagors, you know, are they psychopathic? Are those individuals working within those solicitors firms psychopathic? Is the solicitors firm itself psychopathic in nature? There just seems to be no empathy, Richie, you know, no empathy at all.
There isn't any political party or any individual that's ever tried to take this on. In Ireland, there's been an enormous effort by various groups of people, really good people, activists, people whom you know, to try and bring attention to the people of Ireland. Because we're a small country, just over 4 million people. And, you know, the eviction rate in Ireland is as bad as it is anywhere else in the world. And, you know, they're banging their heads against the brick wall, trying to get the political class to take it on. But, of course, the political class is up to its neck in it as well, isn't it, in the fraud. And there's no, I can't see any major political party saying, right, okay, as an issue, we're going to tackle this before the next election. We're going to deal with this perpetual, never-ending fraud and the misery that it's causing people. It's so difficult to get, to even get this on the agenda, to get this talked about on the news. I mean, I wanted to talk about taking this.
Well, sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
That's a good point about the political class there. The political class have no responsibility. Well, they have a responsibility, but they behave completely irresponsibly towards the British people. They're an absolute disgrace. And if I was to tell you that, once again, if your listeners want to check out an interview on Russia Today, on Renegade, the programme Renegade Inc., you'll see that Michael Abernethy touches on the fact that Lloyds Banking Group has done a deal with the MPs in the British Parliament, whereby they will not be they won't become bankrupted as long as they don't bring up this very subject, banking fraud. And it's recently, it came out some time ago, that we all know that the Soros Foundation funds certain movements, across the planet. But also, there are certain Zionist organizations that are funding certain right-wing groups over here. Nick Griffin himself said he was offered a deal with the Zionist group and they would receive funding as long as they didn't criticise the banking system.
That's Nick Griffin, the former BNP leader, has said this, hasn't he?
Was he taught? I don't know if he was talking about the EDL at the time, but certainly after that you had the rise of Tommy Robinson, Stephen Laxley Lennon.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's funding available for him and the EDL, and you've got to question, well, where's that coming from? Particularly if, you know, you see footage of Tommy proclaiming himself to be a Zionist, and there's a photograph of him on a tank in Israel, an Israeli tank. So, you know, he never goes near this subject, Richie.
No, they won't touch it, no.
You know, I'm not saying that. I mean, a lot of the stuff is valid and is important, you know, like the freedom of speech issue, for instance. But what we're saying, and the film lays this out in stark detail, is that the big issue is financial fraud. And in this particular case, the Great British Mortgage Swindle. Can I just give a little plug while I've got the dates in front of me?
Absolutely, Michael, go ahead.
Because we've now got confirmation that the following screening is going ahead. May the 3rd, I'll just mention a few. May the 3rd at 7:30, the film's been screened at the Odeon in Belfast. On the same evening, which I believe is a Friday, it's been screened at The View in Islington and at the Odeon in Streatham, South London. And also that same evening at 8:30, Cardiff, a place called The View, and at Glasgow at 7 p.m. the same day, and in Birmingham, the Odeon in Birmingham. And then, as you mentioned earlier, it's been screened in Manchester on May the 4th, which is a Saturday.
Brilliant.
At 8:30 at the Odeon in an area called the Great Northern. Is that down by the canals?
Northern Quarter, yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful there. This is, by the way, the Great British Mortgage...
Oh, sorry, it's also been screened in Liverpool on May the 9th. Those are the...
Oh, it's in Liverpool as well. Fantastic. Yeah. The website, by the way, is thegreatbritishmortgageswindle.net. Thegreatbritishmortgageswindle.net. There's a link there to watching the film on demand. There's a link to the box office there where you can go and see this film. 11 million illegal mortgages and 3 million people in this country unlawfully evicted from their homes. They were coerced, they were swindled, conned into signing a mortgage deed, not having a clue what was really going on at the time they were doing it. They were not told and not advised by their solicitors as to what was happening. They didn't know any better. And Michael has been talking about the results of that then. You know, the alleged debt, the fake debt, and often in many cases leading to an eviction from a financial institution that didn't take any risk, that loaned credit, that was loaned into existence out of thin air, usury or interest tagged onto that, meaning that it could never be satisfied ever, or at least in society, there would never be enough credit in society to ever pay back these institutions. Very few people in the world know about this. This is a fact. I've been lucky enough, Michael, over the years to be speaking with people like Jim Mars, who wrote, and God be good to Jim. Jim died a couple of years ago. A great friend of mine. Jim wrote a book called The Trillion Dollar Conspiracy, which is an amazing expose of what you've been talking about. You and Michael Benicia have made this film, which is it's vital for people to see this. And people, Michael, have been inspired and have gone into court and laid this out as part of their, I don't want to say their defence, because they didn't do anything wrong in the first place, but as justification for what happened. People have said, do you think that going forward that there might be success in the courts, in the eviction courts, if we want to call them that, using this knowledge and these factual claims? What do you think?
I don't think anyone should be going into any of these courts. It's a rigged game. The judge always finds in favour of the bank. He's as tied into it as the politicians are with regard to these deals that we've got with the Lloyds Group. It's a rigged game. There's no way around that. What the film does lay out, though, is a plan of action that people can take outside the court system via the land registry with simple applications. And we're going to be setting up a website shortly for people to get in touch, and so we can organise in various local areas, people doing a group action on a specific on their specific land registry, district land registry, should I say? But that will be all, but the film lays it out. So I'd advise anyone to avoid going into court at all costs.
Try and stay away from court at all costs. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had a tweet from a listener who said, look, things are so bad in the country for people who can't afford a mortgage that they're renting, right? And because the government sold off the family silver and sold off all the council houses in the country, which was a disgrace, of course, it was a crime against humanity to do that, which is what they did, that people are stuck in the rental market. And I've had a tweet from a listener who said, you know, if you're in London, Manchester, Birmingham, Leeds, wherever it happens to be, you're paying £700, £800, £900, sometimes £1,000 a month rent. And if you don't do that, you don't have a place to live. So along comes a three-bedroom council house for sale, and it's £105,000. I can get a mortgage, and I'm only paying £300 a month instead of paying the £800 a month rental. Michael, this is a genuine message. It's a private message I've sent. Michael, I've got to go for that and sign that mortgage deed. You see, this is the problem people have. Go ahead, Michael.
I can understand that completely. But we've also got to ask ourselves, ultimately, where is the money going that's being taken off people in these extortionately high rental agreements that they find themselves in?
Yeah.
Where's it ultimately going? Because a lot of them will be in buy-to-let flats, which have mortgages on them, buy-to-let mortgages that are being serviced by the landlord. And every time there's a hike in the interest rates or, you know, a change in his payment plan, that gets passed on to the people who are renting the house. It's just all grossly inflated, you know, and if people look into how inflation is used to steal the real wealth off the people, they'll understand. I mean, I'm living in Nottingham at the moment, and I can recall when I was a student many years ago that you could rent a room in a house for £12 a week. This was back in the 80s. It must be 10 times that amount now.
Oh yeah, it is. Easy.
You know, and how much is, you know, then you look at the value of a pound back in, say, 1986, and just what the value of the pound is today, and you'll see the inflation. And, of course, congruent to that is the fact that people's wages have hardly increased over the last decade. You know, it is the last decade, isn't it, mainly?
That's right.
Since the financial collapse of 08.
Huge story that, which got ignored. It just disappeared last year, that people's wages haven't risen in real terms for over a decade. So everybody is struggling. I mean, look, I don't have too many secrets with my listeners. We rent a three-bedroomed house in South Manchester. It's semi-detached. It was well kept by the owner, so it's in good shape, but it's not big, and we're stuck paying £900 a month. That's what we pay. I mean, and we can barely...
Oh, that's massive, isn't it?
We can barely cover that. I'm not trying to pretend that I'm poor. You know, Caroline works in financial services, ironically. She works for a big firm, collecting money, sales and stuff like that, for getting money from creditors that... She works for a company that sells stuff to other big companies, and you get the picture. So that's what she does. She's got a full-time job. Listeners support this program, and like we get to the end of the month, and we just about do. And I know that pretty much everybody else listening to this program is in that situation. So I'm not, you know, looking for any sympathy here at all, but that's the reality for us every month.
That's the reality for everybody.
For everybody.
And that brings us back to what we were saying at the start about how... The appeal of the film is immeasurable, really. The potential is huge because it's such a salient issue that the politicians are never going to go anywhere near. An issue that doesn't get addressed in the controlled media, because they don't want people thinking about this stuff. You mentioned the guy earlier who you said is an economist. I did. I'm not boasting here. I'm just saying as a fact that I studied economics up to A level, but I was never taught how credit is created.
No.
How the money system really works. What was behind it? Who was the real power behind the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, etc. Now, why would that be the case?
Yeah.
I mean, the answer's simple. But the answer,
yeah. Well, I mean, in high school, in year two, year one and year two, we had a class called Commerce, hilariously, and did it. And they never touched upon what a bank actually is. We learned how to do basic bookkeeping, how to keep a ledger, and that, and payment books and stuff, and that was it. But yeah, there was no real examination of finance, the banks, building societies, what it is they actually do, and educating people. That's why when we spoke off air today, I meant every word of it. This is a brilliant subject. It really is for people, because I think you can awaken people to this. When it comes to other issues like terrorism, like geopolitics and other things, people, they don't want to know, or they can't get their heads around it. But this is key to everything. And I think
you're right. And this is, you know, currently people were very, rightly so, very frustrated with the political class and this interminable delay with Brexit, etc. And a lot of the time, Richard, they'll think, well, what can we do about it? Well, this film, forget all that that's going on in the theatre at Westminster. There's nothing really happening there of any consequence anyway. Bring it back to your home, to your own home, and think how much of your sweat equity, the money you've earned, is being stolen each month by the banking cartel. Because that's what it amounts to.
And what they're not stealing from you.
You can do something. The film outlines a course of action people can take via the Land Register. People can actually do something about this instead of being frustrated at what's going on in the theatre of politics.
And that's important, that it's a film that offers viable and workable solutions for people as long as enough people come together. I'm going to mention
that. Yeah, and that's why I think it's great. If people can support the theatrical screenings and get along to these cinemas, they'll have a great time, because the film, it's an emotional roller coaster, but it's also a film you want to talk about with other people after you've seen it, certainly. And, you know, there'll be people in the cinema of a like mind to yourselves, and, you know, people will just hit it off with one another.
Too right, they will.
Perhaps in unforeseen ways, you know.
I'm looking forward to seeing it in Manchester. I mean, said to you today, I hadn't watched it. I've been watching various clips of it. I saw the interview. Yeah. I saw the interview with, I mean, the clips are absolutely brilliant. I saw the interview on RT. Kudos to RT for covering it. You know, fair play to them. It's about the last place, really, in mainstream media that will do anything as important as this. It's just massive, this. It's such a huge issue. It really is the eye-opener. Like, it's like taking the red pill in the Matrix, this, when you understand this. The Great British Mortgage Swindle.net. Again, I'm making a very emotional appeal here. If you go to the website, pay to watch the film on demand. If you go on to Amazon, buy the DVD, because this is real truth here. And I hate that term truth, because it's a cliche. I hate the term truth and truthers. It's too cliched and all of that. This is absolute dyed in the wool, in your face, what is happening in this country and around the world. And these filmmakers are courageous. Michael has talked about having gone through it himself twice. You have to watch it, The Great British Mortgage Swindle. Now, I'm going to give you the final word, Michael, before we run out of time. You've got about 30 seconds. Final word to you, mate. And I look forward to meeting you in Manchester. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the programme. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, the film is a call to action. People, maybe wringing their hands with frustration of what's going on around them in the world. And there are various aspects that are seemingly unfixable, but you can begin to make real change in your own life. That's good. That's for the better, for the best of everyone, by supporting the film. And if you are skint, then it is available free on Amazon Prime, so I understand. So, but having said that, you're right. We do appreciate all the support we can get, and the monies that we make from the film will be going to rehouse those people who've lost their homes during the actual filming of the documentary.
Did you hear that, listener? The money made from the film is going to help rehouse those who are featured in the film, those who lost their properties. That's an amazing thing. I wish...
Not all of it, but some of it's been set aside for that purpose, yes.
Of course, yeah, but you have cost to cover, but any profits, that's quite amazing, Michael. Listen, all credit to you, and do mention us to your colleague and your friend, Michael O'Bernicia, because big thanks, big shout out to him as well. Thanks for making that film. And again, I urge our listeners to get on to the greatbritishmortgageswindle.net, watch it, buy a copy of the DVD, and invite five or six of your neighbours around to watch it. That's the thing to do.
That's a very good idea.
That's the thing to do. And then at the end of it, then pour the tea or pour a little whiskey or whatever and say, right, what did we just watch there? What the hell is going on? And do that. Michael, thanks. I have no doubt, mate, you'll be back on this programme again in the future. Thanks for coming on. Godspeed to you and more power to you and to the people who made that film with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Richie. I've enjoyed it.
Cheers, Michael. That was Michael O'Dara, the co-producer of The Great British Mortgage Swindle. A factual documentary, not conjecture, not opinion. 100% right. The creation of credit, mortgage fraud, how that all ties into so many other things that we talk about, you and me, on a daily basis. Support it if you can, and brilliant to have him on. That's it for the programme. Right out of time. Gotta go. Thanks to Hayden Hewitt and thanks to Michael O'Dara. Back again with you tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m. UK time with more chat and more guests. Going to leave you with this from Eagle Eye Cherry from 1998. A vintage year. Look after yourselves and one another. Speak tomorrow, Thursday. Until then, it's bye from me. Bye now.